the way that the team leaders that are in Zimbabwe on the YWAM base that we were staying at, the way that they handled the aftermath of this event is really, for me, what comes down to the lack of education, the lack of resources, the inability to actually have leaders who are trained in any kind of trauma response, incident response.
It's the opposite of trauma-informed. Holy and not fuck. That we ever thought that YWAM was trauma-informed. No. They are not.
Quite not.
Shit. It just makes no sense that they're out to go save the whole world and they can't even protect their own. Welcome to Holy Ghosting, a podcast about deconstruction and rebelling against religious leadership. I'm Lindsay Stranigan.
I'm Meg Weber.
I'm Soraya Johnson.
And today on the podcast, we are giving you part two of our series on YWAM, otherwise known as Youth with a Mission, the worldwide global phenomenon, overreaching bullshit missions organization. Last week, we chatted with my sister, DL Mayfield, about the history of YWAM, about the visions of waves of white young people who were taking over the world for the Lord. Spoiler alert, gross. We think that's gross. We're not fans.
Mm-hmm. Not a fan. No manifest destiny, okay? Just stop it.
Let's just
hard stop.
Colonizing the world for Jesus. It's a good time for us to not do that.
It's a great time. So if you haven't listened to part one, go back, listen to that. It's not necessary before you listen to this episode. We more get into like what YWAM is, how it was founded, their bizarro kind of mission, how they suck young people in when they are young and impressionable and don't know any fucking better. And it is real culty, the way that they keep them in, the way that they use trauma and kind of this group trauma. I don't even know what to call it. This thing called plumb line, where you're confessing all your deepest, darkest sins. It's pretty messed up. And so today we're going to talk to Meg about her experiences with YWAM because she is the unlucky one amongst us. She's the only one of us three who actually did a full-blown YWAM DTS. I dodged that freaking bullet, so sorry.
And hearing Meg's story makes me extra happy that I never did YWAM, because I gotta say, I just don't think I would have done well. I think they would have been like, get the fuck out. And I would have been like, actually, yeah, I think I should.
I just had no interest. I mean, I had gone through enough of it as a kid, like doing the family DTS that we did, so I had seen it and just how... I just remember being like disoriented, even as a kid. Like, I'm just so like, I was just like, this is a mess. Like, this is not well run at all.
There's no plan. There's no spreadsheet for expenses. Like, come on.
You can get this done. Seriously. No, seriously. Like, my eldest sibling rage would have gone full force and I would have just tried to take over the whole thing and it would have been a disaster for
me. Yeah. Yeah. So today we're going to hear Meg's story. We'll give a little trigger warning here at the top. We do get into some heavy topics. Specifically, there is nearer to the end of Meg's interview, she talks about a physical assault and altercation that happens, and it's pretty intense. And then also the reaction of YWAM is just negligence, racism, like you name it. So protect your peace as always and know that kind of it's a little lighter at the beginning. More talks about Meg's friendship that she formed during her time at YWAM and then later in the episode. So if you need to bounce at any point, we get that. So let's get into it. Let's hear about Meg's experience in Young Wolves After Maidens.
Mm-hmm. You want a marriage?
You want a minivan? I wish.
Mm-hmm. That's so good. That's so good.
Yeah, so Soraya and I never did a real DTS with YWAM. My family did one when I was young, so I have experience with YWAM, but I never myself have gone through a DTS, gone through the school. And so, Meg, we want to hear from you today. We've heard a little bit. You've talked somewhat about your experiences with YWAM. You've gotten a little bit into some of the story you're going to tell today. Like, I feel like it's, in my mind, the main story of your YWAM experience. But yeah, before we hear from the various listeners that we're sharing today, let's get into it.
I'm talking to you like I'm interviewing you, Meg. That's fine. Which is dumb. But I'm not interviewing you. You're my friend. Ask all the questions you want.
Tell us about YWAM.
Meg, what is your first and last name? Where were you born? Tell me your relationship with Christianity. Just kidding. I fucking know that.
What are your astrological signs? You know, the big three.
So witchy over here. I can feel Satan, his claws coming through the screen.
That's what I'm always trying to conjure. So I'm glad I'm successfully making that happen.
Yeah, you successfully cast that spell, you little witch.
Just little Jezebel over here.
Sorry, just a slight derail. Yeah, so let's get into it, Meg. When did you go to YWAM? How old were you? Was your prefrontal cortex fully formed?
Oh, goodness, no. You know, that took a long time after my YWAM experience. I was 18. I talked about when my husband came back from his DTS in our last episode, and he just kind of shared like how it had changed him and the experiences that he had.
Who was not your husband at the time. You did Correct. Not get married at 18. You waited until the old age of 20.
So you guys could both do YWAM. So cute.
I mean, I will say the one thing that I really loved and appreciated about my experience was just the ability to be away from my comforts, from my family, from my home, church, community, all of that, and my friends, and to just step into a world where I was just me walking in with no pretenses. I could just exist. And that was a big deal for me as like a young, naive, you know, Christian girl. And it was a big deal. That flight to Australia was, you know, 20 something hours long. I cried for most of it. It was hard to leave everyone. But when I landed, I just kind of was like, I'm here and I'm going to be committed to this till the end. And spoiler, the end should have come a lot sooner for me, which I'll get into in my story. But
can I ask a question? How did you choose Australia? Like what?
Well, that was Andy.
Oh, okay. Okay.
He went to the Melbourne base and, you know, it kind of just opened the door. I don't know how he chose that base. It seemed like the furthest point away from where he grew up. So maybe that was it.
It's a good way for Christian kids to escape. I honestly totally. Think like your family's going to be all on board and it gets you to like go to some corner of the world you've never been to. It is, as we have said before, traveling the world on God's dime. So, you know, way to get to Australia, Andy, and then Meg.
Yeah. I mean, and the church was already supportive. They had already supported him doing it. So when I was like, hey, I'm doing this too. They were huge supporters of YWAM at our church. And so he and I eventually ended up getting back together. We had dated previously to that, and we ended up getting back together during this interim time of like him coming home and before me leaving. And what's so interesting about that is that when we got engaged, everyone at the church assumed that I would not go on this mission anymore. I had already been accepted when we got engaged. I turned 19 and we got engaged, and I was supposed to leave like 4 or 5 months later. And I was like, absolutely, I'm still leaving. Like, this is maybe my one and only opportunity to have an independent experience outside of family, church, or marriage. And so
that's really depressing.
I'm like, seriously, like having almost a panic attack.
I'm so sad for little Meg. I should laugh. It's fucked up.
Now's my chance to do one thing ever. Yeah. That's wow.
I mean, it was an opportunity that like I knew I wanted and needed.
Yeah. Good.
Which, you know, I said was God because everything, all of those good things come from him.
Has to be from God. Yeah.
Has to be.
And, you know, that Sunday when they were praying for me to send me off to Australia, I felt nothing but peace. Like I was really ready for it. And so 19-year-old me, in 1999, landed in May for my DTS in Melbourne, Australia. And I mentioned this before, some of my most cherished friendships were born there. And, you know, people that I haven't seen since before 2000. But they'll just always have places in my heart. And one was a boy
Sus, shocker.
But you were already selected to be owned by a man.
But that was the best part about it. It was such freedom for me. Like to walk into a DTS and say, I'm engaged. It just took something away from like the fear of being hunted, you know, young wolves after maidens. And it kind of just was like a free pass to just be friends with people. And especially with guys, there was no concern or worry for me. Like I was so, so in love and just like had no interest in looking at anybody else in a romantic way. And so when I got to meet one of my very best friends, he also had a girlfriend at the time and was very into her. She was gorgeous. Oh my God. I met her and I was like, I am no threat to anyone. Okay. She is bomb. He also had twin sisters. This was a family that I spoke about that lived there that I was able to have some familial energy with. And his parents were super sweet and lovey and nice and kind and just so generous to me and welcoming me. And they were a really important part of my survival, I think, in being away from everyone I knew and loved. And I had a great experience with like weekends or like evenings off and just like, you know, I'm going to call my friend Jay. And Jay was from Melbourne. And so he just knew all the fun places to go. And we just had a really good time, like, you know, almost missing the last train to get back to base after being out on a Sunday and having dinner with the fam. And he and I used to take walks in the evening and just kind of share our lives with each other. I was really homesick and I was heart aching for my fiance. And he really supported me in that. He was a really good friend to me and helped me kind of process that emotional distress. And he was just a really safe person for me.
Question. Do you think, I find it interesting because I think that most like young Christian women weren't friends with guys. We weren't allowed to be. It was like poo-pooed. It was just not cool, right? You know, you were told it's going to be a problem. They're going to fall in love with you. They're going to look at your boobs, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And it was interesting because I think we're similar in the sense that I got along way better with guys than I did with girls. It was just my personality. I liked being outside. I didn't, you know, just certain things. I wasn't super girly and I loved music. And so I would connect with, and yeah, it was so, it was just not allowed. And I wonder, did you have guy friends before or was it truly just the being engaged that gave you the freedom to, because I'm surprised that you did form such a close friendship with a guy. And do you think that that was it? Just knowing that like, okay, I'm taken in, and that like opened up a part of your heart where you were like, oh, I can be friends with a dude. That is allowed.
I mean, potentially, but I mean, yes, it absolutely played a role with me just not worrying about being an object of anyone's anything, which was really nice. It kind of makes you platonic. But no, I had grown up with an older brother and with three boy cousins. There were two older than me and two younger than me. And I was just the only girl right in the middle. And I just was comfortable around them. And that's who I grew up with. That was my family. I loved playing sports. I loved being outside. I loved roughhousing. I was like a regular kid when I was with all the boys I grew up with. They didn't really treat me differently. I could throw a ball really fucking good. So, you know, I was the one they wanted on their team when we were playing baseball. But I had always had friendships with guys. My husband was one of my best friends before we ever dated even. It was him and I and another guy. And they, I guess, had a conversation often about which one of them I was going to end up liking or going out with. And I just was kind of like, I don't know, you're both just goober boys. Like we have fun together and hang out. And there's like, you know, less emotional drama when you're closed off emotionally from a person. Like you can't be hurt by somebody if they're not, you know, if they don't hold any power over you. And I had just found it easier to have friendships with guys because they were so surface level. Like, they didn't get into a lot of deep feelings. And the deep feelings that we all did get into were just God related. And so it was just very safe. But with Jay, I feel like we just, I don't know. You just meet somebody and you are just cut from the same cloth and you just feel a kinship, you know, with a person.
I don't want to derail this, but I also do think it's valuable to recognize just as we're talking about this, because I relate to that. I always was like, I'm friends with all the guys. And I had a couple, like I always had one or two really close girlfriends, but I was usually just like mostly hung out with boys because I was a musician too. Like I just was doing stuff with guys all the time. But I think there's some level of internalized misogyny and also competition that we're pitted, women are pitted against each other. And I'd say like in high control religion in particular, because there's sort of a sense of like, there can only be one, like with everything, as I feel like I just say every episode now, but—
Unless there's love languages and then there's five.
Then there's five, but basically they're like all the same thing, which is just pay attention to the person that you supposedly love and like be kind to them. I don't know. It's so basic, but— Yeah, I think that's actually really valuable and important. The other thing that I found in all of my engagements since I was engaged so many times in Christian college was that I totally understand that feeling of like, oh, well, like I'm taken. So, you know, these other relationships aren't threatening to me or to anybody. And it's really easy when you're raised in purity culture to be able to shut down any kind of sexual tension that might arise or other feelings that you're not comfortable with. And I think that's also a part of this. That's really interesting. But anyway, basically good for you, AP Weber, for locking that shit down before your woman left and went to Australia.
That's right.
Yeah. You would have had some debauchery. Just kidding. You were such a good girl. You would never.
No. I mean, but this relationship did cause issues, not for me and Jay.
I was going to say, YWAM loved your friendship, right?
Not so much. We kind of became the poster children for what was not allowed. We were brought in front of the leadership of the base, separately and together. We were told that our relationship was immoral, that we were not allowed to be alone together. If we were in a group, there had to be more than three people. It had to be a larger group of people.
The Mike Pence rule before Pence was a thing.
Honestly, more than three people too? Like, what is that? That's so weird.
I mean, we had a good foursome going. We had, there was another guy, good friend of mine, and then another girl, also still good friend of mine today. And the four of us just kind of like were forced bonded together, I would say, by the leadership. Mm-hmm. But it did not deter Jay and I. We rebelled. It was a big moment of rebellion. I mean, we were told to not be alone together ever and that our relationship needed to end. As many times as I talked about the love of my fiance, you know, my relationship with my brother and my cousins, like all the stuff I just shared with you guys, it didn't matter to them. I was a girl, he was a boy. That was it. Like they saw the closeness that we had. They saw the friendship. They saw how we supported each other, you know, in these like trauma dumping scenarios. And it's really, really challenging to not give a shit about a person when they're going through something hard, when you care so much about them, but you're told you have to ignore them. It's just like, I was not capable of doing that. He was not capable of doing that. And so we would sneak out. It was super fun. We would use our friends to help us. And one of us would get something to smoke and the other would get something to drink, usually tea. We would go out of opposite sides of the base. We would exit completely on other sides of the base. And then we would meet in a park that was really close by. And we would share a smoke and we would drink tea. And a lot of times I would be crying about how homesick I was or about, you know, my fiance or missing my friends. And other times we would just share about life. He would tell me about his girlfriend. She had a child from a previous relationship that he was being an amazing father to. And I just, there was no threat between us. There just was no threat there. And all of the things that they tried to tell us were gonna happen or were bad about it, it's just none of it rang true to me.
And like, what were they so afraid of? That's what I don't understand. I mean, that you were gonna have sex. That's what they were afraid of.
That we were just gonna like passion ensue and fuck each other. And then, you know, again, that would be a different kind of end of the world. Their need to control and protect people.
And again, you are adults.
Oh yeah. He was also, I think I was 19 and he was 24, 23, 24.
Maybe they just thought you guys looked hot together. I don't
understand.
That's
what like, I think.
I honestly think that like these, because I also don't know how old your base leaders were either. Like, are they around in their 20s as well? Are there like some older people?
No, our actual base leaders were like a married couple. They had younger children. They were probably in their mid 30s though. You know, they weren't super old because their kids were young. And then, yeah, every other quote leader on the base was in their 20-ish range. The two people that took us on our mission were 21 and 22. And all of the leadership was very uncomfortable with Jay's and I's relationship. And so it became like a major thing that everyone would talk about. And it kind of, I mean, it really did push us to just be secretive. Like I was like, again, like you said, I was an adult. I was in the first stages of my life of asserting like who I am and what I wanted my life to be. And I wanted a friend and I wasn't going to deny myself that because other people were making up insane stories about what they, you know, were fantasizing that we were doing. And so
you got to have someone to talk about. Like, this is part of the joy of being in a Christian group is like somebody is going to be the bad lady in the group who's like creating shit for people to talk about, even though in this case, you're like so innocently just being friends with somebody. And I, you know, we have that like drive in us to create some kind of drama to be entertained by as just as people. Like, I think we love gossip and it's interesting, but it's also a way to make you into a example for other people, right? Like, oh, if you're going to do this kind of rebellious stuff, you bring a rebellious spirit of Jezebel into the room. You're, you know, look how badly it will go for you because we're all scrutinizing and talking about this other person, which then also creates some sense of safety for the people participating. And that's part of why I think people will glom on and be like, yeah, it is bad that they're friends or that, you know, whatever is happening. I also want to just point out like to listeners there, one of our episodes, Little Rebellions, I think it was from 2022. There's some more of the story in that as well. And this is like kind of framed in here's a little celebratory rebellion that happened when you were young. So anyway, I also just have to say that like listening to the way that these people were trying to micromanage your friendships and life, this is another reason I didn't do YWAM because I like I went to Christian college and I complied with all of the like lifestyle guidelines and junk, but I also would have been pissed if someone was literally coming at me and being like, you can't be friends with Ray or Bill or George or whatever. Like I went to a Christian college. So like apparently a lot of people had old man names there. Yeah. But those aren't real friends I had.
That's so funny. I will also say, I don't want to rabbit trail too much because this is supposed to, we're just kind of doing an intro here. But I will also say it's so interesting how they will pick apart your friendship, your innocent friendship with this guy. But yet, does church leadership ever, like when there's a sexual assault scandal or when a real assault actually happens, like when sex that is unwanted happens, the cover-ups that happen in high control religion, it's just, it's so bonkers to me that like the time that they spend like nitpicking your friendship and they just won't ever, we know this, this is why we have a podcast where we are talking about high control religion, you know, whether it be evangelicalism or this huge missions organization that doesn't protect people and they spend their time shaming you, making you feel guilty about something that you trying to control your friendships. And
And, you know, their model works clearly. They bring in young people and it is hard for young people to leave. And yeah, we're not fans. I hate that you went through that. And I love that your little rebellious spirit started here. Like this, yeah. You were such a good girl. And I like that for the first time you were out on your own and you're making your own decisions and you were seeing like the fucked up leadership that happens in these places and you like did not stand for it. And I love that for you.
So a minute ago, you mentioned the DTS, and I would love to hear more about what our means. Was that you and Jay, like you went on the same mission as well?
Did the Lord call you to the same country? The Lord would never, he would separate you.
When you went and deliberated on your own in your prayer closet?
Yes. So the day that they announced the different options for where you could go on your mission. It was different every time, every DTS. What I found out later was it was kind of up to the leaders. Like, I think it was like, what country do I want to go to? I'm going to take a group of youth there. And so they didn't tell us who the leaders were going on individual trips. They just told us locations. And then they made us all separate. We could not converse with each other. We had to go into separate spaces, hear from the Lord, and then go tell a leader, this is where God told me to go. And then we had to remain separate until every single person had told the leader, this is where God is sending me. And they debated for quite some time after we had done this, just the leaders. And I think I'm just going to go out on a limb and say they were debating because Jay and I had both come back with the same exact place that we were supposed to go on our mission. And when God tells you, how can they argue with God? Like they did all of these safeguards to ensure that we had no time to converse, that we had nothing. And we came with the same mission. And so they had to allow it. And it was a really big deal. We had a big sit down where they were like, yada, yada, God says, like, but here's the strict rules for this. Your relationship cannot maintain during this trip, like you have to stay separate. I can't remember if there were like 8 or 9 of us. Like it wasn't a huge group of people. But they kind of put our leaders on high alert where they were very much ensuring we were not seated together on a plane. We did not ride, you know, in a car next to each other. We did not have our sleeping quarters like close to one another. It was like the vigilance that they had. And so of course we had to just be creative, which I'm great at. So turns out my little rebellious spirit was just like, you know what? I feel right. I feel right in my heart about this relationship, about who this person is, about the bond that we have built. And I'm not going to get rid of it just because somebody else says so. Like these people don't know me. They've barely met me. They don't know anything about my life and my integrity. My only concern was making sure that my fiance like knew everything. You know, he met Jay like over chat. He chatted on the phone one time with him. It was like, that was my only concern, was that my fiance wasn't, you know, concerned or worried at all about our relationship. Which I think he was, because that was like what we were told. It was like, mm-hmm. If a girl and a guy are hanging out, there's always going to be sex stuff. So, you know, fast forward to we're on our mission.
What country did you go to?
So we went to multiple countries. So this story kind of takes us on a little global journey. We went from first from Australia to Indonesia. And then we were in Malaysia and Singapore for a period of time, a few weeks. And when I was in Malaysia, I was wearing contacts at the time and I scratched both of my corneas. And so I was blind for days while my eyes were healing. I had to keep them shut at all times. If you've ever had an eye injury like that, like the burning, you can't let light in. It's like horrible. And so Jay became my eyes. We would link arms. I would hold on to him and he would guide me through the streets. Like I would still go out with them and participate in all the things that we were supposed to be doing, but blindly. And so he was really there to just, I mean, he just didn't allow them to separate us at that point. Like, he just was like, I am absolutely going to make sure that she is safe and watched over and, you know, doesn't just like trip and fall down a flight of stairs. And the leaders were kind of like forced to allow it. But since we were all in a group setting, like, I think they were kind of like, okay, it's fine. But then, you know, a girl has to take you to the bathroom or whatever. And then we went from Asia, we went to Africa, and we ended up going to 3 different countries in Africa. We were in South Africa, we were in Zambia, and we were in Zimbabwe. When we were in Zimbabwe, which was where we spent the majority of our time in Africa, we had a free day where we all were able to go to an internet cafe. It was so fun, you guys. We had to go to these cute internet cafes and like you pay your for your hour and you're on there and it's so slow and you're just trying to email people, you know? There's no way you're going to chat.
Do I have an email from my dude? I remember writing letters to a dude that I wasn't even like, it wasn't my boyfriend or anything. Like, we were just like kind of seeing each other.
Scandalous.
And he was not a Christian either. And I went on a missions trip.
Double scandal.
To Uganda and was like emailing him. I even brought him like a little wooden giraffe.
Cute.
Yeah. I mean, I was also fornicating with him. So really I was.
What? Just kind of seeing each other. You know, casually.
But I do remember being in an internet cafe in Africa and just being like, oh, messages from home is the best.
Yes.
If you haven't had that experience, people, like to the youth of the world who now have like iPhones that work in every country, let me tell you, it was a different time.
Back in my day.
It was a different time. Anyways, you're DTS. You're in Africa. You're in Zambia specifically.
Zimbabwe,
so sorry.
We're in Zimbabwe. We're out at this internet cafe. And there's a group of like 7 of us that have gone. And as we're walking back, there's little markets on the street. And we kind of start to like separate into little groups. So there are 3 women behind us, 2 from South Korea and 1 from Indonesia. Jay and I are in front of them. And then there's 2 more Australian guys that are like ahead of us, and then some people who were delayed. So as we're walking, him and I cross a busy street. We're walking on like a main kind of fast street. We cross a little side street and pass 2 men who are standing in the crosswalk. And, you know, we smile, make eye contact, and pass by. And the next thing I know, they have come up behind me and grabbed me and are starting to drag me back towards a car that's down this side street. And we end up in the fight. We end up going down into a ditch that's off the road. So like no one driving by can see what's going on. But Jay is there and he sees the weapons that they have. He sees the car that they have waiting with a door open, and I see it in his face because I couldn't see any of this the way that they had grabbed me. And I see it in his eyes and he just turns into this like beast. He's not a huge guy, but he is not going to let me be taken. He's not going to let me go. So he's grabbing onto me. They're threatening him. I see the kind of stress that is on his face. And I realized this is something that I need to really like go to the bat and just like use all my strength to fight. Eventually they let me go and, he takes me back. The way that the team, the base leaders, the team leaders that are in Zimbabwe on the YWAM base that we were staying at, the way that they handled the aftermath of this event is really, for me, what comes down to the lack of education, the lack of resources, the inability to actually have leaders who are trained in any kind of trauma response, incident response, any of that. I remember asking to go to a doctor to be seen. My body was in so much pain. And, you know, first came prayer.
Of course.
Second was just my isolation from other members of the team, including Jay. They separated me from everyone and said that I just needed to focus on my own healing.
What the fuck? They didn't even call anyone from the famous YWAM counseling school to come and
No.
continue fucking with you?
Or ask you what you wanted?
No.
Because you wanted your friend Jay and that was not going
They're
to
like,
happen.
Let's separate the weak one from the herd. Let her deal with God.
Like, what in the world?
Eventually, I did end up going to a hospital. I had x-rays. There were some cracked ribs. There was some really intense external. I'm not going to get into details. Yeah. It was a really traumatic experience. Mm-hmm. And it left me with a lot of physical. There was a lot of visible evidence of the assault. But the way that it was handled after I got back from the hospital was that I was instructed to come downstairs into like a main kind of living room space. I was unable to wear sleeves after this event because of how my arms, like the insides of my arms and my back and my body were really torn up, and anything that kind of touched the skin just was excruciating while I was healing. And so I ended up having to wear tank tops, which was a really big deal.
The worst possible outcome.
Yes. For everyone. They really tried to get me to like wear sweaters. So I eventually would wear like oversized sweaters, like in Zimbabwe, like in the middle of the summertime, to like not show my arms or my shoulders or anything.
Because modesty is what we're concerned with in this
like
scenario.
Your torn up arms are going to make our brothers stumble. Like,
yeah.
I just want to punch something. Like,
yeah, it makes me so
what the fuck?
Angry.
That, I cannot. Actually, just hearing this tank top detail is throwing me over the edge.
Yeah, like, I haven't heard this
that
detail.
Makes me extra angry. Like, I don't, that is fucking fucked up. Like,
yep.
What the fuck? So, isolation and then covering you in hot clothing in Zimbabwe. Cool.
Yep, that was another thing they asked. But I think the worst part of this experience was when they called me into this room. I was able to sit close to Jay at this point. I kind of had just told them, like, you don't get to tell me who gets to be around me. Like, he saved my life. Oh, 100% he saved my life. And he was my protector. And I wasn't going to be away from him. So the two men that had assaulted me were both Black. And they had decided that the best course of action for the spiritual warfare that had been going on was that they were going to invite a lot of Black men to come into this room and to, quote, humble themselves in front of me and like beg me for forgiveness on behalf of these other men. That this was supposed to heal me and like help me like not be afraid. Of any Black men who this were like, in the country.
This is gross on every fucking level. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it was the most traumatic
expression.
Yeah.
It's the opposite of trauma-informed. Not that we ever thought that YWAM was trauma-informed. No. They are not.
Quite not.
Shit.
Yes.
Because that's damaging to you. It's damaging to them.
Yes.
Every time another man would walk in the door, and I, as I mentioned, I had looked at these two men in the eye. Like I had looked at them in the face. I had smiled. I had like acknowledged them. And so every time a new man would walk into the room, I would have a flashback. I would worry. I thought multiple times that the men who had harmed me were going to be in that room. I mean, it just is a psychological trauma response.
Right.
And yeah. they wanted to lay hands on me. They wanted to touch me. They wanted to, you know, heal me with prayer instead of, you know, with therapy or with anything that would have done good. And if that wasn't like hard enough to have as an experience, I was then used as a poster child for gaining more financial support, for combating the spiritual warfare. I was highly encouraged to stay and complete my mission so that I didn't let Satan win by like, obviously they said, you have a reason for being in this country. There's like, he's trying to make you leave. And so you have to stand up against that and you have to stay. You have to, and I was very determined that that seemingly like from God saying, hey, if you're going to heal from this, if you're going to, you know, redeem this experience, then you need to stay here and you need to endure and you need to continue to put yourself and your emotional well-being like on the back burner.
Well, because it's spiritual warfare. Like it's actually not about you at all. Yep. It's about the spiritual warfare supposedly and also the fundraising opportunities that right. You just became such a great YWAM story for YWAM.
For the base, for the mission, for the group I was on, the DTS, for everyone.
What a testimony.
Wow.
Because that was my problem is I never gotten in any trouble. So I had a really crappy testimony. And look at you. You hadn't gone through enough trauma yet to have a good testimony. I'm sorry. I know that like we deal with stuff in humor, but I don't even feel like I can fucking make jokes. I was trying to make a joke and now I'm walking it back no. because I'm deeply uncomfortable joking about the fucked up shit that they did to
yeah.
you.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also like, it's just a really horrifying magnifying glass on the behavior of high control religious groups in general.
Yeah.
And the fact that they took this traumatic moment for you where your body and your brain were, and your nervous system, like all of these parts of you were just shattered and squished up and like mangled. And then they're like, okay, so this isn't about you. It's about spiritual warfare. And like, thanks so much for being a part of our battle. Like, it's just disgusting.
It's another indicator that your body is not your own.
Absolutely.
It's 100%. It's 100% such a dehumanizing way to treat people, to treat an experience like that. I can't even imagine the feelings of the other, you know, students, kids who were on this DTS with me who observed this experience. I was really grateful that the three women who were behind us didn't encounter these same men. I was actually really relieved that it was me and Jay that had come upon them first and that he had been there and was going to protect me to the death. Needless to say, after this event, him and I were in fucking separable. No one was ever allowed to tell either of us what to do, where to be, who to sit next to. He was next to me in like contact with me, either holding my hand or touching my, you know, shoulder with his shoulder. Like he always was near to ensure that, and he was so vigilant. I mean, I can't even imagine for him, a young adult to have experienced that. And then to realize like he was the only thing that stopped this. He was the only reason that I was still alive. And the just that burden that must have been on him for the rest of that trip. I mean, that emotional trauma for him is something that no one even talked about. No one discussed. I mean, he was the hero and that was the end of the story for him. Mm-hmm. And neither of us had any kinds of support that we should have had. And frankly, we were the support for one another. We continued to do our private conversations. We would have our like walks around. You know, I didn't go outside of the walls for a while I was there. And I mean, for a while, I think it was like maybe 3 days that I stayed within the walls of the base. And he stayed with me. He stayed back behind from the things that we were supposed to be going and doing. And really for us, the mission changed in that moment. And it was not about saving other people from anything. It was really just a time for us to try to caretake in the very lacking knowledge that we had
of trauma or of healing or any of these things. Like, we just did our best and we were there for one another. And when we got back to the base, I went back to the leadership of that base and I told them how wrong they were. And I told them that I would be dead if I had listened to them. I told them that I had rebelled, that we had continued our relationship, and how grateful I was for that, and how the ways that they had tried to dissuade our friendship would have gotten me killed. And I 100% know that that's true. And it was a big time for me to stand up to authority. It was a time that I learned not only to listen and trust myself, Sarai, like you were saying, but to also know that other people who say they are an authority of you don't have that power unless you let them, unless you give it over, unless you say, I will do what you say, I'll ignore myself and my needs. And it was an opportunity for me to say no to that authority. And that helped me to grow up. Yeah. It did. It helped me to gain some personal strength. And I do not credit YWAM with that at all. They can go fuck off. I credit that with me. I credit that with Jay. I credit that with my other friendships that I built there. And I know that this experience is not unique. I haven't talked really openly about this story a lot in my life, but I know that it's important, especially important at this time, knowing that YWAM has not slowed down, but they have continued to cause these types of harm across the globe. And we are going to hear from listeners, some of their stories and their experiences, the fucked up things that they participated in and the things that they endured as well. I have nieces that have gone into YWAM that have experienced horrific judgment and just harms that they're still dealing with today. And this is just one story out of so many. But we need to speak. It's no longer okay for us to be silent.
Yeah. It just makes no sense that they're out to go save the whole world and they can't even protect their own, right? Like,
yeah,
they're so concerned with the mission. And this is a thing, I mean, I remember that being a pastor's kid over and over. And this is a thing I know my dad like fought against, but you know, everyone, pastor's kids are known to be so fucked up because their parents give it all to the ministry. They're not there for their families. The ministry comes first and your emotional health and well-being is jack shit. It's not even that it comes second. It's like not existent or not supposed to be. And yeah, we know all this stuff. We have lived it. We have seen it. And yet still when we get into it, like you can see how mad we are. Like it's been a long time since we've been in these systems, but the devastation is so far reaching and like the effects that it has had on us. And I'm like proud of us for rebelling and for getting out and for you to be in it and stand up to them and be like, no, you were wrong. Like so many people don't ever get that chance and don't get to have that voice. And I'm really grateful you were able to say that, even if it came at a cost of like, you had to go through a really, really intense and awful experience for you to even feel safe enough to say that, right? Or to prove to them how wrong they were. I'm certainly grateful for Jay and for your friendship and that you did not go with the flow, as it were, and listen to their bullshit rules.
Whew. We are holy ghosting. And just as a little, I don't know, what's the word in a fable? Oh, the moral of the story. The moral of this story is trust yourself, listen to your own intuition, and know who you need to be around. And it doesn't, no one else needs to have that be their business. And, you know, there's so much else to take from this. And I think that big piece is we don't need to be silent. And in fact, we can't afford to be silent when it comes to our own oppression, the oppression of other people. And in letting people know when they're causing harm, especially when they're perpetuating a harm kind of infinitely throughout the ages because of this one big wave of whites. So speak up, tell your story, be honest. Like the more that we're able to share these challenging things and bring them out of the dark, the more that we can shine a spotlight on the truth and be able to, you know, keep the worst ills of this from continuing to perpetuate in new young people's lives and in all of the nations where these ridiculous factories of white people going on missions are occurring. And the same kinds of behaviors, the same kinds of strategies, the same kinds of tools are still in play. And it is no longer okay for that to continue. And it really hasn't ever been, but let's just be honest and let's just be honest, like loud about it and share the truth with people. Of course, as always, you can find us lurking on the internet.
And stay tuned. We are going to have part three of our YWAM series. We decided to split this out into three parts because we just have a lot of shit to say about YWAM. So next episode will be listener stories. We're going to hear from people who traveled the world for the Lord with YWAM. And it's just batshit. It's really crazy. Some of the stuff that they did and were asked to do and the places that they went. There's chicken butchering in a prison. Like there's some weird stuff goes down.
Stay tuned for that. Mm-hmm. There's some bonkers stories.
You won't want to miss it. So,
and as always, you can engage with us online at TikTok and Instagram. You can find us on YouTube and over on our Facebook group. We would love to hear from you, hear your stories, and help all of us know that we are not the crazy ones, that we experience these bonkers things and we are not alone. If you like what we're doing and you want to support the show, please come join us over on Patreon. You can join for as little as $5 a month and help sustain the production of this podcast, or you can subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you aren't able to financially support us this month, please come and support us with your presence. We would love to have you interact and talk with us either on our Facebook group or over on Patreon. You can join us there as a follower, and you don't even have to subscribe if that's not possible for you right now. We appreciate all of our supporters, and we are so happy that you all have decided to invite us into your lives. And we hope to see you again next week. Bye, Ghosties.